All right, so welcome to the Saturday morning call. Of the six people that we've got on, four of them are here on the island. That's kind of amazing. And that since Kristen is about to go to a retreat, we can talk about some of the things that he can do to get his mind ready for that. And that always, we can start at the very beginning. And that the place that I find at the beginning is that the Buddha taught only one thing. Both formerly and now, he teaches, or he taught, dukkha nirodha. Now, what that means is that if you can see dukkha as dukkha, then you can do something about it immediately. And yet, much of the Western meditation systems don't do that. They're not looking for immediate results. They're looking for long-term results. And that the actual teachings of the Buddha have to do with results that we can get right here, right now, immediately. And so, in that regard, we can look at the Eightfold and Noble Path as part of that teaching of dukkha nirodha. In fact, the first thing that we do is we unpack the dukkha nirodha to find the Four Noble Truths. Now, the very first dhamma that the Buddha taught, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, that's in the Samyutta Nikaya, at least it's historically known to be the first sutta, was when he chased down the his old cohorts that had been following him around, and they abandoned him and went to the Deer Park while he stayed in Bodh Gaya. And so after he figured out really what the mind was doing, and how we wind up in dukkha, that in fact he actually kind of formalized what he was actually looking for, because he spent 6 years looking for something without being quite sure of what it is that he was looking for. And that seems to be the case with almost everyone. We're out looking for something, but we don't quite know what it is that we're looking for. And oftentimes people do not understand that what the Buddha taught is really all we need. We're looking for something special, and yet the teachings of the Buddha is absolutely ordinary. It's what we're doing right here, right now. Now, in this Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he basically started off that talk with the middle path. If you can keep in mind that everything is associated with middle path, that any time that we go to one extreme or the other, there we'll find dukkha. That the dukkha will always come away from the middle, from the extremes to the middle place. And there's many, many different ways to understand the middle path. It almost applies to everything. The food that's too hot, or the food that's too cold, and the food that's just right. You can think of past and future are two extremes, and right here, right now, is the middle point. And we can also understand that the further away from this point in time, this here now, which is actually the only reality that there is no reality in the past is gone. There is no reality in the future, we don't know what's going to happen. The only reality that we have is the reality that we can experience, touch, taste, smell, investigate right now. And the further away from reality, which means the more conceptualizations we do about what's happening right now, then the closer to dukkha we're going to get. That's an important point, that if we can stay with what's real right in front of us, then there's no dukkha there. The dukkha comes from creating stuff in the mind. So, from that perspective, we can start looking at the second part of the teaching that the Buddha gave, beyond the middle path is the Four Noble Truths. Now, they're actually called noble because they're long-standing. Those noble truths were true before the Buddha. They were true for sure during the time of the Buddha, and they remain true. They're almost unaffected by whatever reality and circumstance it applies. This is why they're called noble. And then, in fact, we use the word noble on a regular basis in the sense of that which cannot be easily polluted. Like, for instance, gold is noble. It doesn't rust. It can flake off, but it's still gold, just a small bit of it. Also, there are noble elements other than gold. In fact, gold is not quite as noble as, say, argon, xenon, krypton. Those are noble gases. And what makes them noble is that they have a balance of electrons. And so they don't either need to give one away, nor do they want one. They're neutral. And because of that, they don't interfere. If you can bring your life to that kind of point, that balance point, that middle path, then you're not affected by whatever happens. And so this is what we mean by the noble truth, is that we can see dukkha. That first noble truth is, can you see it? If you can see it, you can understand its nature, understand its cause, and if you understand the cause of nature, you can recognize dukkha very easily. But it takes skill, because in our culture, we have taught that dukkha is the way to go. You do what you're told to do. You learn your ABCs, your 1, 2, 3s. We start off in childhood as victims, and that victimization means that you've got to change. You got to grow up. You got to do this, that, and the other thing, which makes us being affected by stuff. We're not noble. And so what the real practice of the Buddha is to come to a state where we're not affected by reality. And we don't try to create reality. We don't try to create it out of what it should be. And we don't create it out of what we want it to be. We just let it be the way that it is. That's reality. And so, if we can actually see the dukkha, then we can step around it, avoid it, not deal with it, and come into that state of dukkha nirodha, being free from dissatisfactions, immediately. And really, all we have to do is to practice getting out of the dukkha that we find right in front of us over and over and over again, because it's going to be flying in all directions most of the time. Things keep changing over and over again, and because they're changing, people don't like it, and so people are finding all kinds of dukkha, all kinds of dissatisfactions, because reality is a change model. It's in flux, and if we can understand that, then we can really understand how to come out of that dukkha by using that fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Noble Path. Now, one of the things that's very interesting about Western Buddhism is that they don't practice the Eightfold Noble Path. That, in fact, many times you'll hear Western meditation teachers drone on for hours or weeks at a time, and they never talk about the Four Noble Truths. They never talk about the Eightfold Noble Path, nor how to apply it. And so this talk, Christian, I want to make sure that you understand what the Four Noble Truths are, all the way down to the Eightfold Noble Path, and how to apply it. And the trick to applying it is right now. The second trick to applying it is to understand the first three items of the Eightfold Noble Path. Now, most of the time when the Eightfold Noble Path is taught, it's taught in a kind of an ordinary way. And when I say ordinary, I mean in the sense of sila, samadhi, panya. But the Noble Eightfold Path is not sila, samadhi, panya. It starts with panya, develops samadhi, and winds up with the result of sila. But in fact, for children, we give them precepts, we give them rules. The Bible has the Ten Commandments and all kinds of other rules. We've got English common law. Really, the only reason why all of these rules exist in the world is try to control people's behavior, primarily because they're too stupid to figure out how to live happily all by themselves. And one of the reasons why they're too stupid is because everybody around them is stupid. They're rule bound. Things are supposed to be a certain way. And so this is how we start our children, teaching them precepts. But in fact, the real teaching of the Buddha is not for behaving oneself. It's not for going along to get along. It's for freedom. Freedom from dukkha, freedom from want, freedom from suffering, freedom from all kinds of stuff. And almost always our dissatisfactions are ordinary. So in a way, freedom is an ordinary thing. So let's look at the Eightfold Noble Path. And the first item on the path that the Buddha talks about is right noble view. Now, most of the time, people will think of the right noble view as kind of a viewpoint, a worldview, a way of looking at things. But in fact, these are just concepts. Both wrong view and ordinary right view are concepts. But the noble right view is actually a verb of looking, investigating. Something that we're doing right now. And it's got a twin brother. And that twin is what is called sati. It's translated as mindfulness, but mindfulness is not a very good translation of the word sati. The word sati has the quality of remembering to wake up, to remember to be in this present moment. If we can remember to be here now, then we can take a look at what's happening right now. Inside the mind, outside, wherever we're looking, whatever sense organ that we've got, we can see what's going on only when we're willing to look. And we can only look when we remember to look. And so sati winds up being an important skill to be developed. But then the third item on the list is the one that's most missing. Mahasi has the noting technique, and that noting does have the quality of remembering to note and then to do the noting. However, that's not enough. The way that I would look at it is that there's actually another kind of meditation called Vajrayana, which has the quality of choiceless awareness, which also has the quality of looking at what's going on, waking up and looking at what's going on. But their choiceless awareness means that they're just going to step right in it. They're choicelessly aware of it. And the teaching of the Buddha is about choices. We got to make choices. Now, the Mahasi method actually wants you to note and note and note and note and note until you get down to the bottom of it. So let me give you this example. It's my favorite. I use it on a regular basis since I thought of, and that is that imagine that you're walking down the sidewalk or a path, and right in front of you is a big pile of dog doodle. The Vajrayana is going to see that dog doodle and choicelessly step right in it. The Mahasi method is going to take that dog doodle into the kitchen, dissect it, put it through the blender, mix it with egg and breadcrumbs, and cook it for lunch and eat it. But the way that the Buddha would talk about it would be to just step around it. Don't deal with it. You see it as dukkha. You see that that pile of crap is a pile of crap. Don't step in it. Don't play with it. Avoid it completely. And do that right now. So if you can use that example, we can now talk about what is, in fact, right noble effort. So we look at what's happening in the mind, and then we immediately make a change, because mostly what's in the mind is that dog doodle kind of stuff. And if we can see it that way, then we can make a change immediately. And one of the things that the Buddha was quite famous for saying was the phrase, "Aha, I see you, Mara." Now, actually, if we can say that, if we can see what's happening in the mind and say, "Aha, I see that," that's making a big change right there. You've gladdened the mind already. Now, that's not the same thing as noting it and then not liking it. Oh, I'm worried. Oh, poor me. I've got worries on the mind. It's not the right way to practice. The right way to practice is, aha, I see that worry, and I can put it away right here, right now. I can stop doing it right now. That's the real teaching of the Buddha, is what we're going to practice is making a change right here, right now. Now, one of the things about making a change is that most people are not used to making changes. We stop making changes probably in childhood. The way we study is the same way that we studied when we were in the third grade. The way we did stuff, the way we communicate with people, the way we live our lives, our favorite foods, and what we eat is probably the same thing the way that it was when we were 8, 9, 10 years old. And we haven't made much change since then. But the world has been changing quite a lot. This is part of the reason why we suffer so much, is because we haven't recognized that things have changed and they will continue to change. So what we're going to do then is start looking at the kind of thought patterns that we have and make a change to them. And that change, I'm saying, is important. Aha, I see you, Myra, fits in exactly with the teaching of the Buddha about the Anapanasati practice. That in fact, you could go so far as to say that the Buddha did not teach meditation. The way that you understand meditation, going to a retreat, sitting on your butt in a particular kind of hall for a particular period of time, doing what you're told to do, is actually quite ordinary. You've been doing that kind of stuff at school. So going to a retreat is nothing special, and most people do not enjoy their retreats. They're not taking their time and using it wisely. And so the wise way to use your time is to look at the thoughts that you have and make a change to gladden the mind, to start practicing Anapanasati the way that the Buddha taught, rather than practicing meditation the way that it's practiced in the West. And so I will say also that there was quite a kerfuffle back in the 1930s when Bhikkhu Buddhadasa made the statement that the Buddha only taught Anapanasati as a practice. And they say, oh, well, there's these 40 meditations, you know, but those 40 meditations are not in the suttas. Those things come out of the Visuddhimagga. Then, in fact, the Visuddhimagga is the basis for the Mahasi practice. And yet, the Buddha didn't teach out the Mahasi method. He didn't teach that stuff. Then, in fact, that came 1,500 years after the time of the Buddha. Maybe 1,300 years, but it was quite a while. But what the Buddha did teach was the four foundations of mindfulness and how we apply Anapanasati through the Eightfold Noble Path to fulfill the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four foundations? Well, you've got a body, you've got feelings, and basically what feelings are, is the chemistry that's going on in the body. And then you have your attitudes and the states of mind, which is just more chemistry. And then you have the thoughts and the fleeting things that come in and out of the mind, the dhammanupassana, and that's still just more chemistry. And so if we think of the four foundations of mindfulness, this is in fact the old four elements: solid, liquid, fire, and smoke. Those were the original four elements. And we're applying that now inside the body. And so all four of these elements can be, in fact, investigated. The way that we would investigate it would be like this. We start with the body to make sure that the body is breathing well. Long, deep, easy breaths in order to get to know the body for the purpose of relaxing the body. We also are going to start looking at the mind, gladdening the mind, seeing what the mind is doing, changing the attitude of the mind. And in fact, we can't even control our breathing unless we're controlling the mind. And with being able to control the breathing and controlling the mind, we can begin to control the feelings. And how we get started with this is by looking also at the kind of thoughts we have. The easiest thing to change is the thoughts. The second easiest thing to change is our mental attitude. The third easiest thing to change is the feelings. Why? Because we feel this way and that way sometimes throughout the day, but the body changes very slowly. But we start with making sure that the body is comfortable. I find it really surprising, in fact, that these meditation teachers teach people to sit for a long time, because everybody gets uncomfortable. The Buddha was not into making the body uncomfortable. He was into making the body comfortable so it could relax. It's really hard to become comfortable and relaxed when you're sitting for long periods of time with the idea that I can't move. And so this is one of the things that I would mention for people who are doing a retreat, is don't try to follow some rules. If you need to move your legs, move your legs. If you need to get the body comfortable, get the body comfortable. If you need to stand up in order to get the body comfortable, then stand up. Don't sit there because you were told to sit there. You have been doing that since you were in the first grade. And look what it's got you. Not much. So, if we can, in fact, begin to control the attitude of the mind, we can do that by the thoughts. The thoughts will change the attitude. The attitude and our other thoughts will help change the body. And then these three things together will help change our feelings so that we can begin to feel the way that we want to feel right here in this present moment. This is really the teaching of Anapanasati as we apply to the Eightfold Noble Path. But we've only talked about three items on the Eightfold Noble Path so far. Only three of them. So what would be the next one? Well, before we go into the next one, we have to understand that we need to practice these three things over and over and over and over and over again to begin to get some good results. What are these three things? Is to wake up and take a look at what you're doing and make a change for the better. Wake up, take a look, and make a change for the better. This is what we're going to be practicing in that retreat over and over and over and over and over again. And as we practice that over and over and over again, several things happen. One is that we begin to feel more relaxed. Number two is that we recognize that we're actually in a safe environment. We don't have to think about things that are going to be dangerous. One of the things that happened with people who were on these retreats for the first 3 days, they'll worry about all the dangers and all the problems that they had in order to get to the retreat. And then when the retreat is about over, the last 2 or 3 days, now they're thinking about the plans that they've got to do and their travel expenses and all of that kind of stuff. And they only leave a little bit in the room for the middle to actually practice correctly. And then they don't even bother to practice correctly then because they're trying to follow the rules instead. But if you're practicing correctly, that means that you begin to feel safe and secure and comfortable and then satisfied. Can you get yourself into a state of being satisfied? Practicing being satisfied over and over and over again. Keep coming back to being satisfied. Why do I insist upon satisfaction? Because satisfaction is exactly opposite of the dukkha of being dissatisfied. And so we want to start practicing being satisfied. Wow, this is okay. Wow, this is all right. Yeah, I can sit here. Yeah, everything's all right. Not a problem in the world. This is what we need to start practicing, is to become satisfied, safe, secure, comfortable, and satisfied, contented. We're not looking for magic. We're not looking for bliss. We're not looking for the pie in the sky or the Buddha on the shelf or any of that kind of stuff. We're not looking for nirvana. That in fact, if you can just chill out and be satisfied, that's nirvana enough right there. Being chill, being cool, being satisfied, being okay in this present moment. If we continue to do that over and over and over again, then another element of the Eightfold Path begins to kick in. This is called Sammasankhapa. It's translated wrongly as right thought, and it's translated more correctly as right intention. But a better translation would be right attitude. We're actually beginning to change our attitude, the attitude from being a victim into being a winner. Only victims go to retreats. Winners don't go to retreats. Victims go to retreats. Victims are there as students. Victims are there as the volunteers. Victims are there as the course retreat runners. Victims are there as the teachers. They're all a bunch of victims. The question is, can you practice coming out of your victimhood into being satisfied, being successful at being satisfied? The word in the Pali that we can talk about is the word sada. Now, in the Sanskrit, it's shraddha. You know, there's these R things, like the difference between Dhamma and Dharma and Kama and Karma. Well, we've got another one, shraddha and sada. And sada actually is translated often, a bad translation. This is the one of the worst translations. They translate it as faith. And really, it's got nothing to do with faith. And it has everything to do with success. It has everything to do with confidence. We know that we can do this. This is the Sammasankhapa, the idea that we can change our attitude from being victims into being successful, being winners. And so there comes a point with this where we get the position that no matter how obstructed the mind is with hindrances, no matter what kind of unwholesome thoughts there are in the mind, I can clean that stuff out, come back to reality, see the things the way that they really are. Now, this is confidence. To say it doesn't matter how obstructed my mind gets, it doesn't matter how bad I feel, I can change that. I know I've got the confidence that I can change my state of mind. So if we can do this over and over again to change our attitude from being a victim, needing a meditation, into, wow, I've got nothing to do. I can just sit here. I've got this wired. I've got this made. Beginning to have the attitude that you got it. That's the success. And this is the way that we add that fourth element to the Eightfold Noble Path. So that four elements together, that point of remembering to see what's going on, to make a change, to do that over and over again until we can change our attitude that we can do this. These little successes, one after another, I can change my mind. We change our attitude, and with that, the fifth element of the Eightfold Noble Path comes into play. And this is Sama Arya Samati, Noble Right Samati. Now, Western translations of the word samati is downright unwholesome. They translate samati as concentration. The only reason that I would use the word concentration is in the sense of repetition. You do it over and over and over again. What do? We change that unwholesome thought to a wholesome thought. We gladden the mind over and over and over again. We keep telling ourselves we can do this over and over and over again. We keep saying over and over and over, everything's okay. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. The spring comes and the grass grows all by itself. Hot diggity dog, I can manage that. Hot diggity dog, that's the attitude that we want to cultivate. Because if we have those four elements together, that begins to unify the mind. That's what samadhi really means. It means unification of mind, gaining the mind and getting it together. I'll give you an example. Imagine that you had gone into the attic and you'd found an old grandfather clock, or maybe one of these cuckoo clocks or something that's about this big. And you take it down and you take it apart. You clean every gear, you fix all of the bearings, and you put it back together so that the clock is working correctly, all cleaned out, all set up, and ticking, doing its job. That's the clock that's samadhi. Now, let's talk about concentrating that clock. Let's take that old clock and take a sledgehammer to it and make it not this big, but it's down this tight, this big. I don't think that that's the real thing that you want to do with that alarm, with that old cuckoo clock. And yet that's what we think of with concentrating the mind. Another way of looking at concentration is that concentration means you take something out of it, like frozen concentrated orange juice or condensed or concentrated milk. But in fact, no one drinks frozen concentrated orange juice. What do? With it? We put the water back in it. We, in fact, make it whole again. We make it samadhi. So in a way, concentration is exactly the opposite of samadhi. Samadhi means we're putting everything together and getting it all working correctly. And now the mind is organized. And with the mind that's organized, with the mind that's whole and complete, that's in a position of being noble. The mind is in a noble state. So if we can bring the mind to the point of, I know that no matter how obstructed the mind is, I can clean that out, bring the mind back to a state of success and satisfaction, then that will unify the mind. So that we don't want anything. And in fact, that's another thing that you can say that we've been practicing all along, is by practicing being contented and satisfied is another way of practicing not wanting anything. Not wanting enlightenment, not wanting nibbana, not wanting to show off to the other students, not wanting something special, not wanting sotapan, not wanting arahat, not wanting past life experiences. Look how much crap people want from meditation. Then, in fact, the real point is that anapanasati practice is a dead loss. You're not going to gain anything. You're going to lose your crap. You're going to lose your unwholesome thoughts. You're going to lose your fear. You're going to lose your discomfort. You're going to lose your dissatisfaction. You're going to lose your victimhood until there's nothing left. So if we can do that, then we're also losing our desire so that we don't want anything. Now that's the fifth element. So now, Ivan, we can start talking about the question that you ask in the sense of, well, now that the mind is unified and whole, and we don't want anything, then we're unlikely to go kill somebody to get it. If we are whole and unified and successful and happy and safe and secure and don't want anything, then we're unlikely to go rob somebody to get it. We're unlikely to go shoplifting. Why? Because shoplifting and doing that kind of stuff brings dukkha back in. We want something. We're already in a state of dukkha when we're in there casing the joint to shoplift or to pull out our gun. We're already in a great deal of turmoil. But if you walk into that store just completely satisfied, everything is hunky-dory, your mind is unified and whole, the most likely thing is happening is you're going to turn around and walk back out of the store because you don't have anything in there that you want or need. You're already okay. So this is the way that we would really approach what is sila, what is morality. Morality is when the mind is already so okay, so satisfied, so safe and secure that we don't go harming people. We our actions are correct. Our speech becomes correct. That in fact, if we're safe, secure, whole, satisfied, we're not going to tell lies. There's no reason to tell a lie. We're also not going to compete and compare ourselves with others because you're already okay. You're already just fine. And so that means that whatever we have that brings us livelihood, we can do that from a position of safe and secure. We don't have to lie. We can just allow people to buy what they want. We don't have to sell them anything. But in fact, in the sutta that I'm spending most of the time talking about, which is sutta number 117 in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Great 40, which is an exposition of the Eightfold Noble Path, there in the right livelihood, it's mentioned buying and selling. That in fact, monks don't buy anything and they don't sell anything. But people who are involved with buying and selling, for instance, you buy dirt and you make cement and you sell cement. That would not be right livelihood. You buy grain and sugar and yeast and make some joy juice and then sell that. That's not right livelihood. Or you take a bunch of old parts, you hone them and make guns out of them and then sell those guns. That's not right livelihood. Making things that people are going to feel bad about would be not right livelihood. So what is left with right livelihood? Okay, I'll give you an example. In fact, this is one that I've been working with one of my students, Michael. It would be good if he were on the call to listen to this. And that is that he is a school teacher, but he needs some extra money because I think his wife is pregnant or they've got a kid that's sick or something and the wife's had to quit her job. And so he wants to take on a second job. And he's thinking about bartending. Now, a lot of people who were rule bound about Buddhism and all of that would say, oh, well, that's not right livelihood at all to sell alcohol. Well, guess what? Barkeeps don't sell alcohol generally. They just serve the alcohol that people walk in there to buy. Right? You don't have to sell alcohol. You can just serve it. And along with that, you can serve up a whole lot of Dhamma. That in fact, I've been told, and I can understand it, is that the best bartenders wind up being the best psychologists. They don't sell their psychology. They don't sell their booze. People come and buy the booze, and then they get loosened up enough to where they can begin to hear the truth. So if you have that kind of attitude, then you wind up being an excellent psychologist in a bar. But if you think that you're out there to sell alcohol, that's not right livelihood. I know that those two things are very close together, but if you have some wisdom, you could pull those things apart and see that they're not the same thing. Ivan, do you have any questions about this?
No, not at the moment. I'm just thinking.
All right. Well, think some wholesome thoughts now. Oh, Ross, good to see you turn your video camera on. Yeah, do you have any comments?
Oh no, that was a great talk. I'm just struggling to visualize the Buddha saying "hot diggity dog" in an Indian accent. But it was a great talk. Thank you, Damarello.
Right. So that whole idea then about right livelihood is when everybody wins. That in fact, one of the things that you could say about a good barkeep is that he doesn't want to get people drunk. He doesn't want to have any fights. He wants people to come to the point that they don't need the alcohol because they already are feeling good. So you could be a clerk in the store and you could answer people's questions, but you don't have to recommend anything. You don't have to sell them anything. You can let them make up their own minds and make choices. There's a number of professions that we can have that would be considered right livelihood, and it all depends upon your attitude. And always that attitude is, do I want something? And if I want something, then I'm going to do something to somebody that's going to put me in a one-up and them in a one-down position. But if I'm happy, safe, content, and secure, then I can have a profession and do it well and enjoy doing it and not cause anybody any problems or suffering. And so this is the way that we would approach right livelihood, but right livelihood already has as a foundation right speech. And it already has a foundation of right action. And it already has a foundation of right noble samadhi. So let's make sure that we're doing things in the correct order. We're not following a set of rules because somebody told us that this is what the rules are and this is how you're supposed to be. We're doing this through wisdom. You're seeing that whatever I'm doing, I'm not hurting people. And so we can back it up even further. If I have that right mental state, that noble attitude, the reason that I have that is because I already have the idea or the feeling or the attitude that I've already got it made. I don't have to sell anything. I've got it made. I'm already the winner. And the way that we get that state of already being satisfied, already being a success, actually starts to build even further, and we can add the quality of wealth, that you're wealthy. What are you wealthy with? Well, you don't have to be wealthy with money, but you can certainly be wealthy with joy, wealthy with an attitude, wealthy with everything is okay and everything is fine. This is the kind of attitude that we can have, and the way that we gain that attitude of being wealthy and successful is because of these very simple practices over and over and over again of changing the unwholesome thoughts into wholesome thoughts, one after another after another. I mean, it's really easy. The mind already is jumping around. They even call it a monkey mind. So if the mind changes that easy, that fast, then it can't be that much work, can't be that much right noble effort to just make another little change in the mind. But there is a way that we have to look at it from the beginning, and that is that if we have not had any much experience, we're not very good at taking right noble effort, then it's going to be a little bit more effort. There's more effort in the beginning, but as we get experience, as we get skill, as we work the right noble effort with the right attitude, if we work it this way, then the effort becomes actually energetic. No effort at all. We just automatically are going to be doing the right thing. And so in the beginning, we have to put in a little effort. I've got a couple of examples. If you're pushing a child on a swing, the first push that you push on, because they're sitting static, the gravity has got them solid and stable on sitting on the swing, and you push that swing, it takes a bit of effort. But once you get the child moving on that swing, all we have to do is just touch it. Just touch it. Just at the right point in time, as soon as that swing comes back up, we just touch it and push it again. And the child can swing and swing. But if we forget to keep pushing, then the child is going to have that gravity pull them right back down and stop. And now you got to put the effort in again to get them going again. Another example would be kids, teenagers. This is an experience that I had when way back when, and the car won't start. We're out on the road someplace, and four of us are trying to push this car down the road. Well, getting the car started to roll is a lot of work. You got to put some elbow grease in it. But once that car is rolling at 1 or 2 miles an hour, you can just push it with one hand and just keep it rolling. So this is the way that we look at right effort. That in the beginning, it takes a bit of effort. And a lot of students will say, yeah, I put in the effort, but my mind is wandering away again, and I don't like that. Well, the effort is that, aha, I see you running away. I see you, monkey mind. Be happy that you have the monkey mind. That's the effort that we have, is to be willing to accept that our mind is out of control. It's okay. Never mind. Start again. Everything is easy peasy if you have the right attitude. And so this is what we really need to change, is that attitude from, oh, it's so much work, oh, this is hard to do, because that attitude will continue to make it hard to do. But if you start pushing easy and get it going easy, then continue. This is the repetition now. Over and over and over and over and over again, you keep making that swing go back and forth and back and forth in that wholesome way. And pretty soon, we feel satisfied, safe, secure, comfortable, and satisfied. But we have to practice this over and over again. That's especially true in these retreat settings, when a lot of the retreat systems are set up to take everything that you've had away from you in order for you to look at your mind. So you don't have your notebook, you don't have your cell phone, you don't have your favorite photos of all of those girls, you don't have pencil, you don't have paper, you don't have books, you don't have the TV, all you've got is your own mind. What a mess that is, until you can begin to change that mind. And so a lot of people, Kristen, they don't like that meditation retreat because they've had to do without so much stuff. Oh, shit. Can you change your mind about it? Wow, I'm glad I don't have that notebook. I've got nothing to do right now. Wow, I can just sit here and just enjoy doing nothing for a while. Wow, I can relax. No place to go, nothing to do. I can just sit here and enjoy the moment, moment after moment. Wow, what a relaxing pleasure this is. Wow, peace of mind. Wow, I could stop doing. Well, you probably know that most heat that we have to deal with has to do with friction. For instance, on the sun, the reason why the sun gets hot is because all of those molecules, all of those atoms, are banging up against each other. The same thing is true within our mind. The reason that we have heat in the mind is because all of these different ideas and plans and all of that to keep banging up against each other. And so if we can begin to bring the mind back to a settled state, with unification of our thoughts, in the sense of over and over again, all we say is, wow, this is so nice. Wow, there's no problem. Wow, no place to go and nothing to do. And I can just sit here and be comfortable. Those thoughts don't create friction, and we can really cool off. And this is what Nibbana actually means, is just to chill out, just to cool off, just stop rubbing stuff and just let it be all by itself. This breath is a nice breath. Let me watch it. And so this is basically all there is to a retreat. It's just to go and enjoy the retreat. Just keep having wholesome thoughts, one after another after another. Now, I can probably tell you that since this retreat that you're about to do, Kristen, is a Mahasi retreat, they're probably not telling you this. They're leaving out some of the most key ingredients. The key ingredient that they're missing is the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, especially the right effort. Especially right effort. Now, the Mahasi method does have noting, but it's noting and noting and noting and noting rather than noting and make a change, noting and make a change, noting and make a change, noting and make a change. They just do noting and noting and noting, and that's why people, they note how miserable they are, and they continue noting how miserable they are. They're going to wind up being pretty miserable. But if you can note your misery and say, oh, I can make a change, and then you note you're miserable again, you say, well, I can change it one time, I can change it again. Hot dog, I can do this. And that's the way to make a big change in your life, is by making little changes, one after another. Over and over and over and over again. This is a very repetitive process. And in fact, the entire teachings of the Buddha is on the back of every shampoo bottle. You go to the grocery store, you go to 7-Eleven, you buy a shampoo bottle, and there on the back of the bottle is the entire teachings of the Buddha, where it says, rinse and repeat. And that's all we're doing, is we're rinsing the mind and then repeating and rinsing it again and repeating and rinsing it again. The entire teaching of the Buddha is in three words, rinse and repeat. The entire teaching of the Buddha is in three words, dukkha, dukkha, nirodha. The entire teaching of the Buddha is in four words, don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Over and over and over again, don't worry, be happy. Over and over and over again, rinse out the mind, keep cleaning it out, and then repeat doing that over and over again. The teachings of the Buddha is not magical. It's not mystical. You're going to lose all your desire for magic and powers and all of that kind of fairy, airy, fairy stuff, because you're going to become satisfied. And in fact, that's what real enlightenment is all about. If you look at the word enlightenment, it's got two qualities to it. One is light. That's like shining a light on it, having some daylight. See the light of day. What that means is knowledge. We're taking a look. This is right noble view, is to look. And then the other kind of enlightenment is not heavy. Lighten up. Drop your burdens. Be free of all of that crap. Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. And if so many people want to get something from the teaching of the Buddha, you're not going to get anything from the teaching of the Buddha. Everything's going to be a dead loss. If you're looking for freedom, the only freedom you'll have is because you've got nothing left to lose. You've thrown out all of that dukkha. You've thrown out all of that defilement. You've thrown all of your burdens, and you've just lightened up. David, do you have any comments?
Sometimes I wonder about people who drink alcohol. Personally, it doesn't interest me anymore. But I'm wondering, like, what is the attraction, do you think, with people, like, why do they drink? It's because they're not already satisfied.
They're trying to drown their suffering. People who drink alcohol are dissatisfied. People who buy cars are dissatisfied. People who go to church are dissatisfied. People who go to meditation retreats are dissatisfied. They're all junkies. I even know some retreataholics. They're all dissatisfied. They're looking for something. Can you come to a state of being satisfied? If you're satisfied, you don't need to drink anything. You're already okay.
Makes sense.
Alexander, you have any comment?
Well, I'm glad that you talked about the right livelihood as you know, the border, the thin border between what can be the wrong type and the right type, especially with bartender. That was kind of a good example, because usually that's one of the example about what's wrong and right livelihood, you know, like selling alcohol, selling guns, for instance. So yeah, it was interesting to hear you.
Forgive me, I will have to admit that I don't hear very well, and that your voice is loud enough, but it's kind of muffled. Michael, can you tell me what he just said? Your microphone is muted.
He said that the example you gave of a bartender was a good example, and showing the difference between a bartender who's in right livelihood and one who's in wrong livelihood was worthwhile. Because when people talk about wrong livelihood, oftentimes one of the things they talk about is, you know, selling alcohol, selling poisons, selling weapons, this sort of thing.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a new guest, Thomas. Thomas, is that your name?
Yes, hello. Yeah. It's in like strictly pronounced Tuomas in Finland, but it might be hard to pronounce, so I will accept any pronunciations. Very nice to be here. Welcome. I feel very welcomed here, and hello all. Really happy to be here. Sorry I'm late, but I just woke up before I joined. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Ross, do you have any comments?
Yeah, just in relation to the advice you're giving to the guy who's going to work in the bar or getting a second job, what I think the only thing I would say about that is he possibly getting himself into an environment where he could get a bit prickly? Like if he's got a lot of drunk people around him and it starts to go off, it starts to get violent, because that can happen sometimes in a bar.
Mm-hmm.
What does he do in a situation like that, where he's confronted with something pretty ugly?
I would say close the bar, and if you don't have time, just leave.
Okay.
Get out of there.
Yeah.
But recognize that there was probably a whole lot that could have been done before things got to that point.
Yeah.
For instance, people who often get angry and violent in a bar is because they've had too much to drink.
Mm.
And so a good barkeep will have them to where they're not drinking so much.
Yeah.
That in fact, he was going to be friendly with both sides and get those guys to be friendly with each other.
Yep. And then the second thing was...
That's what they came for. That's one of the reasons why people go to bars, is they go for companionship and they wind up in a competition and fighting with each other.
True.
So if the good barkeep can keep them contented and happy, then he's doing a good job. And if he's not, he needs to leave anyway. So let's get up and go out. Let's head out the back door. Come back later after they've torn the bar up or something. Go call the owner. It's his problem.
Yeah. The other thing that you mentioned as well about getting something out of Buddhism, like for years, I've always tried to get something out of it, you know, whether it was some sort of amazing meditation experience, some sort of magical thinking, or some sort of superpower. You know, I always approached it. I always approached Buddhism trying to extract something from it. And I just love the way you said that it's actually, when you do Anapanasati, it's about reality and dropping all of that crap.
Mm-hmm.
And just being right here, right now, and everything's good enough.
Everything is fine. Let us hope that we can in fact enjoy the way things are, because you can't really change it. Reality is pretty stubborn. Gravity is not going to bend your way. Gravity is going to do its job. If you fall over, it's going to pull you right to the ground. It's right there ready for you. It's omniscient. It's omnipotent. It's always there. Think of gravity as your God.
Yeah.
And then you can think of the other ones as also. I mean, we've got four primary forces of nature. What are the four? The electromagnetic. We attract and repel each other. That's a force that's always there. Sometimes it's shocking. But it's just always there. Also, the weak and strong nuclear forces are always there. It's all about energy. It's all about the reality, the way that it is. And yet most people are trying to suck up to it. They pray to it. They write Bibles about it. They make up stories about sky daddies and dead man walking. And my favorite, no fuck babies. And they're just stories. People are looking for magic all over the place. They're looking for, you know, guys who float off into the air. And the reality is that gravity, it's got to say so in all of this. So let gravity be your God. And now you can just sit in God's lap. Sitting in the lap of God, everything is okay. Everything is fine. We live in a paradise until you judge that paradise. You destroy your own paradise through your judgments, through your wanting. But it's already okay. So, Kristen, do you have any final comments?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'd just like to thank you for the amazing talk. It's been very insightful. And what you mentioned about what they were lacking in the Mahasa retreats in regards to, for many retreats in regards to following the rules, and the lack of right effort, and committing to changing your minds right here, right now. I experienced firsthand during my first three retreats. You know, my first one was completely hellish because I went
then
in.
Why did you do another one?
Well, I mean, that's a long story. I applied for the second one before the first one, then I got accepted to the first one, and after my first one, I was dissatisfied, you know?
It's because you want something.
Yeah, exactly.
So go spend this retreat not wanting a darn thing. Start recognizing that you keep wanting stuff, but you can rinse that right out of your mind. You can repeat that over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You're already okay.
Yeah, so it's definitely extremely... very good pragmatic advice. that I will try to do or try to apply throughout the retreat. Yeah. Excellent. Thank you so much for the entire speech.
Just to talk. I don't give speeches or lectures or I'm not a teacher. I'm just a Dhamma friend. I'm glad to have you as a friend.
Yeah, likewise.
The world doesn't need another hero. It doesn't need another guru. What we need is friends, mostly to be friends with ourselves on the inside. So does anybody have any final words? How about you, Michael? You got anything to say?
Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel if you're watching this online or if you're sitting with us here now and haven't subscribed yet. It really helps us out, so thank you.
Yeah, you can mention also joining our website.
Yeah, check out opensanghafoundation.org, make an account, browse through it, and go on and help us out. We're having a fun time over on the website.
Yes, be sure to sign up. Thank you a lot. Thanks, guys. We'll see you later.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great rest of the day.
Enough for today.